Honorable Court is again in session. Be seated, please. Case number 11-1265, Americans for Safe Access et al. Petitioners versus Drug Enforcement Administration. Mr. Elford for petitioners, Ms. Watkins for respondent.
Good morning, Mr. Elford.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. When Congress initially placed marijuana in Schedule 1 and enacting the Controlled Substances Act in 1970, it did so as a placeholder until the scientific data regarding its medical value and potential for abuse could be fully explored. Rather than do this in an even-handed manner, the DEA and HHS have played a game of gotcha. The DEA will not move marijuana out of Schedule 1 because it contends that more research is needed, but it will not allow such additional research to be conducted because marijuana is in Schedule 1. This game of gotcha will continue indefinitely unless this court intervenes. To support its maintenance of marijuana in Schedule 1, the DEA and HHS committed the following errors that are divided into three general categories. First, the DEA erred as a matter of law in applying erroneous legal criteria, in particular with regard to the consensus requirement and the known and reproducible requirements, as well as in terms of failing to perform a proper relative comparison with other scheduled substances. Second, the DEA acted arbitrarily and capriciously in weighing the evidence regarding both currently accepted medical use and relative abuse potential. And third, the DEA acted arbitrarily and capriciously in failing to hold a hearing or at least reopen the record for additional submissions. So the question this court may have is, what harm does this cause to the petitioners to the organization I represent? And I'll start with Michael Krawitz, one of the petitioners. Michael Krawitz is a veteran who gets most of his medical treatment from the VA. However, because marijuana is placed in Schedule 1, the VA has determined that marijuana has no currently accepted medical use. And so Michael Krawitz is unable to discuss the possibility of using marijuana for medical use with his VA physician.
Where's Mr. Krawitz's affidavit?
It's attached in our final opening brief. I believe it's the second.
Krawitz.
Yes, I'm sorry. Sounds like Krawitz, but it's in any event, Your Honor. And as is discussed in his declaration, he then has to go to a different doctor besides his VA doctor because of marijuana's placement in Schedule 1. And this impairment of the physician-patient relationship was recognized by the Ninth Circuit in the case of Conant versus Walters, and that creates standing for Mr. Krawitz as well as the other petitioners in this case, or at least Americans for Safe Access. Another harm that's caused here deals with the deterrence of allowing patients the ability to access the medicine that they so seriously need. As is outlined in a number of our declarations, because of marijuana's placement in Schedule 1, there is no medical necessity defense available under federal law. And so patients are deterred from cultivating the medicine they need for fear of a federal prosecution. Now, as phrased in our declarations, some of these patients cultivate some of the medicine but would cultivate more, but I want to focus more directly on the fact that many members of Americans for Safe Access are not able to cultivate at all or feel deterred from cultivating at all because of marijuana's placement in Schedule 1. For that proposition, I'd like to cite the case of Public Citizen versus FTC, 869 Fed Second, 1541 at page 1545, a case out of this circuit from 1989, where the court held that standing is shown where numerous members and individual identification of an organization is not practicable, but you can still have standing by virtue of the fact that you can infer that at least some members of the organization would have standing. And here I submit to you that you have individual patients who are members, or putative patients who are members of Americans for Safe Access, who are deterred from cultivating the medicine they need because of marijuana's placement in Schedule 1. Now, the government contends that this is it's a speculative claim, because even if marijuana were rescheduled, that doesn't necessarily mean the court would adopt a medical necessity defense. And so they claim that there are a number of ifs that have to be satisfied before you even get there. But that's not exactly our standing argument. The point is, because of marijuana's placement in Schedule 1, putative patients are deterred from cultivating the medicine they need because they're afraid of a federal prosecution. And so by simply rescheduling marijuana, that would reduce that deterrent effect. And it's their perception, not so much whether the court ultimately says you get a medical necessity defense, it's their perception alone that creates standing, and that perception would change if marijuana were rescheduled, which by statutory definition means it has a currently accepted medical use in the United States. And for that proposition, that it's the deterrence itself that creates standing, I'd like to point this court's attention to Friends of the Earth, Inc. versus Laidlaw Environmental Services, 528 U.S. 167 at page 184, a case from the United States Supreme Court from 2000, where the court allows people to sue under an environmental law based on their perception of greenhouse gases, kind of regardless whether that perception, in fact, is accurate. So turning from the harm to the substance.
Now, why don't you discuss Getman versus the DEA and distinguish that case, where there was no standing, and that was post the Supreme Court case you just cited, and it didn't mention it.
Getman versus DEA is different in a number of fashions. I mean, one, it doesn't allege the theory of standing that I'm talking about individual patients being deterred in particular because of their fear of cultivating, because that would constitute a federal crime. So that issue wasn't even there. More importantly, in the Getman case, there was no organization asserting standing that had a membership base.
I'm talking about Getman himself.
Dr. Getman was an individual,
right.
And this court held that Dr. Getman had the possibility that he might get some consulting contracts or possible research contracts if marijuana were rescheduled, and this court held that that was speculative.
What Getman contended was, by narrowing the universe of customers of consulting services and also by stymieing his ability to legally conduct clinical and social research on marijuana, its effects and medical utility. Now, why couldn't you substitute by narrowing the universe of patients who can grow marijuana, and then if they face prosecution, they can assert the medical necessity defense and a court might agree with them?
Well, because here you actually have individuals who are directly harmed by their inability or their fear of being able to cultivate. Their fear of being able to cultivate makes it so they don't cultivate, which means they don't have the medicine they need to alleviate their suffering.
But you're not asking that it be taken off all schedules, so it's still going to be illegal if it's in Schedules 3, 4, or 5, right?
It will still be illegal in those situations. However, there would likely be, based on the reasoning of the Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative case, there would likely be a medical necessity defense, and our membership is well aware of that. And so their fear would decrease of a federal prosecution for which they would have no defense would be greatly reduced. That means that their deterrence would be reduced. That means they would be much more likely, that means they would be able to cultivate the medicine that they need to alleviate their suffering. Turning to the merits of the case. First, the DEA errs in stating that marijuana has no currently accepted medical use in treatment in the United States. The Institute of Medicine conducted a thorough review here, and it concluded at page 159 of its report, which is contained in the joint appendix of page 205, quote, nausea, appetite loss, pain, and anxiety are all afflictions of AIDS wasting, and all can be mitigated by marijuana. So it's simply not true that there's been no scientific studies that have assessed marijuana for medical use. And to the extent that the DEA even claims that, it's because the DEA has hamstrung and stymied all efforts to conduct the research that's necessary by maintaining marijuana in Schedule 1, and NIDA, its sister agency, refuses to fund studies that would demonstrate marijuana has medical use. Despite that, there have been studies that have demonstrated that marijuana has medical use, and more have emerged since the filing of the petition, which is why we are requesting that the record be reopened or a hearing be held. In terms of the DEA's contention that that there's not a consensus of medical experts that have agreed that marijuana has medical use, that is an erroneous application of the law. The law simply requires acceptance of the substance, which, as the First Circuit determined in the Grinspoon versus DEA case means generally agreed upon. It doesn't require a consensus, doesn't require that it be unanimous. In fact, in the ACT versus DEA case, this court stated that a concern with the DEA creating impossible to meet criteria, and simply saying there's a material conflict among experts would be an impossible to meet criterion, as the court stated in the Promise toothpaste case cited in our briefs, because you can always find a material conflict of opinion. That gets us to the third error committed by the DEA as regards marijuana's medical use, which is the provision that the substance be known and reproducible. As we've demonstrated in our petition, marijuana is known and reproducible. However, the DEA is creating, an impossible to meet criterion condemned by this court in the ACT case, which is that you have to be able to reproduce every single one of those chemical components. If that were the case, you could never have a botanical medicine. However, Congress, in enacting the Controlled Substances Act, recognized various botanical medicines, coca leaves, opium poppy, and poppy straw, all botanicals, all in Schedule II, which means that they have a medical use, and they don't require that you can absolutely reproduce it every time like a pharmaceutical. And so, again, Your Honors, I would submit that the DEA has applied the wrong legal criteria in this case.
You're not suggesting that we've ever said a consensus is an impermissible standard, are you?
No, Your Honor. This court has not yet ruled on that specific issue. However,
wasn't that adopted by the agency following judicial review, where they were criticized?
Yes, Your Honor. The court in the ACT case did express agreement with the five criteria that were outlined, and one of those criteria was stated as consensus. I guess the real question then becomes, what exactly does consensus mean?
And the real question is to what extent we have to defer to the agency's construction of the regulatory framework, right?
Well, yes, Your Honor. However, to answer that question, Chevron deference is not warranted in this case, where the DEA itself and HHS have taken multiple different interpretations of the statute. At times, they say that the standard is acceptance by qualified experts, which we agree with. And at times, they say, well, a material conflict of opinion precludes such a finding. So they've taken conflicting positions, in which case Chevron deference is not appropriate. So turning to the potential for abuse.
Before you get to that, what about the adequate and well-controlled studies?
In terms of the adequate and well-controlled studies.
So I'm sure I understand. That was one of the five requirements that we approved in Act 2 or 3, however you designate it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Each of the five is required, correct?
That is the position of the agency, yes, Your Honor.
And we said it was reasonable in ACT.
Yes, Your Honor, but that would be based on the facts of that case. The specific issues that I'm raising.
I say reasonable to have those requirements, not that they reasonably applied them in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
But don't you have to address then their contention that there are not adequate and well-controlled studies?
Well, Your Honor, it's our position that there are adequate and well-controlled studies. I mean, what exactly is an adequate and well-controlled study is something that we, of course, would like to further address, since there's been emerging scientific data since 2002, which
Leaving
is...
Leaving that aside for the moment, don't we have to defer to the agency? Defer doesn't mean they win, but defer in the sense of we're not scientists, they are, to the definition of what is an adequate and well-controlled study?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what is your answer to that argument?
Well, the answer to that is again, the DEA has not been but so clear about what exactly it means by adequate and well-controlled study. I mean, they're saying it requires a significant sample size, that you have a double-blind placebo-controlled study. However, the problem here is that the DEA, or rather NIDA, refuses to allow such studies to exist. They will only fund studies that try to demonstrate the harmfulness of marijuana. They won't allow such studies to exist. So under the reasoning of the ACT case, and it wasn't raised directly in the ACT case.
Where that argument that they are not allowing these studies to occur, where is that in your brief? I'm sorry. I'm not saying it's not in your brief, but I feel like I I don't remember it.
I believe, Your Honor, that it's in the appendix to the Institute of Medicine report. I at least know that in the appendix to the Institute of Medicine report, it discusses how research into the marijuana, medical uses of marijuana has been hamstrung by the federal government's efforts.
I understand that, but does your brief argue that this requirement of adequate and well-controlled studies is not possible because, in the same way you argued in Act One, not possible because they're not allowing those? Did you make that argument? I'm not saying you didn't. I just don't recall it.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I don't recall if I made that argument directly either in the brief, although it certainly is implicit in the various, in the statement of the facts.
It seemed like your response to that argument was that you just disagreed about whether there were those studies, not that the requirement itself was inappropriate. I'm not saying that is what you argued. That's all I remembered.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe we argue certainly that there are studies. I guess it's implicit. We argue that there are over 200 studies that are cited in the petition. And implicit in that is we believe those are adequate and well-controlled studies. Then to the extent that they're contending they're not adequate and well-controlled because they come up with some other definition that's not stated in their regulations themselves, it's our contention we meet whatever the definition is, and implicit in that would be the argument that under ACT you can't come up with a standard that's impossible to meet. So it's at least implicitly argued in the brief by us citing the studies, if not expressly stated, citing it to ACT, which I'm citing to now.
But you did not, I want to make sure I understand this too. I think you just answered Judge Garland's question to say, yes, you agree with him or what he thought he recalled, that you did not make the argument in your brief that you will, to the extent that adequate studies are required and they don't think you have any, you're prohibited from completing them. That's not in the argument, as I understood it, either. That was not raised. That is a different argument. That is, you're imposing upon us something we cannot meet because you prohibit us from doing it. I don't remember that argument.
Well, Your Honor, we certainly do argue, as discussed certainly in the reply, when you get to Judge Torella's argument, he certainly discusses how the various, I'll cite from my opening brief. It's actually not in the reply. It's in the opening brief at page 33. I'm citing to the article by Judge Torella, Deja Vu, A Federal Judge Revisits the War on Drugs or Life in a Balloon, in my parenthetical, which follows from the argument that was just discussed. These reports and assertions by federal agencies border on scientific obscurantism by totally ignoring, if not outright suppressing, the abundant credible scientific evidence worldwide, which is contrary to these reports and statements. And so his reference to suppressing the scientific studies is stated at page 33 of our briefing.
You and I, we're lawyers, we understand. It would be a if you were going to make this argument as your argument, it would be a heading or subheading in a brief and says, you know, there's great irony here. They're demanding certain kinds of studies here, but they prohibit us from conducting them. That's not in your brief, right?
Well,
it may be this passing reference in a parenthetical, but that's not a constructed. I did not remember this either, and I want to confirm it because it's not insignificant. That is not a constructed argument in your brief, right?
Well, I mean, Your Honor, it is a constructed argument to the extent I just stated.
Got you.
Okay. In terms of potential for abuse, the DEA failed to engage in the appropriate relative analysis. In the Grinspoon case, the court makes clear that relative abuse potential is the proper inquiry. The Controlled Substances on its face discusses relative abuse potential. So I think it's rather clear that in order for a substance to be considered to have the highest abuse potential justifying placement in Schedule 1, the DEA and HHS must perform this relative inquiry. Here, the DEA doesn't do that. Instead, it engages in a self-fulfilling prophecy. What it does is it says, okay, instead of comparing marijuana to other scheduled substances, we'll compare it to THC and other cannabinoids, which are initially placed in Schedule 1. So THC and other cannabinoids and marijuana were initially placed in Schedule 1. And so what the DEA does is it says, well, we'll just compare it to those, so marijuana has to remain in Schedule 1. So the DEA has utterly failed to engage in any kind of serious relative abuse potential analysis as required in Grinspoon. To the extent that the federal government does, in fact, engage in any kind of relative abuse analysis, it determines that the physical dependence liability of marijuana is, to use its word, mild compared to alcohol, barbiturates, and heroin. In other words, their own relative abuse analysis, to the extent they conduct one, demonstrates that marijuana ought not be in Schedule 1. And since I'd like to save some time for rebuttal, I will simply, I guess, conclude this part with this. Marijuana is less harmful than Schedule 3 substances like barbiturates and hydrocodone. The DEA is only able to place marijuana in Schedule 1 by its self-fulfilling prophecy and its refusal to perform the proper relative analysis. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Ms. Watkins?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. After review of the petitioner's materials, thorough review, and all other relevant data, DEA concluded that there was not substantial evidence that marijuana met any of the criteria the agency uses to define currently accepted medical use, criteria specifically pertaining to demonstrated medical efficacy and safety, available information and consensus regarding such efficacy and safety, and knowledge about and reproducibility of the drug.
Could I, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm trying to figure out what our standard of review is. So the statute requires the government to go forward if there is substantial evidence. And we are supposed to accept the government's position if there is substantial evidence to support it. So is the standard of review, is there substantial evidence to support the administrator's decision that there is no substantial evidence? Is that the way to put it?
That is one way to put it.
Another way?
Because
that sounds funny, but still, it does sound right.
Correct. And as the government stated in its brief, it is the standard of review overall is the arbitrary and capricious standard. At the highest level of deference, because the agency determined not to initiate rulemaking. However, that decision of the agency necessitated certain factual determinations, and so yes, the court.
Right. So, with respect to the findings of fact, says the Attorney General, if supported by substantial evidence, shall be conclusive. Is the Attorney General's finding that determination that the facts that that there is no substantial evidence, is that a finding of fact that we regard for substantial evidence? Or is that something else that we review for something else? Arbitrary and capriciousness, maybe.
Arbitrary and capriciousness in that it is the agency's explanation of why it did not initiate rulemaking.
Okay. Let me just get one other threshold matter. Before your counsel, at least implicitly, argued that this is a Chevron kind of a claim, but are we talking about their challenge to your interpretation of the statute with your regulatory framework or your interpretation and application of your regulation, which is not Chevron?
Correct. They appear to be challenging the agency's application. Insofar as they're challenging the agency's interpretation, we would say that that was upheld by another panel of this court.
Okay, I want to make sure. I think there's confusion. So you're agreeing with what I thought the posture of the case was, that this is not about a Chevron construction. This is about an application of a regulatory scheme that's already been endorsed.
That is correct.
Okay.
As well, the available information did not constitute substantial evidence that marijuana has a potential for abuse less than Schedule 1 and 2 drugs. While we've necessarily raised and briefed the court on the threshold standing issues, I'd like to proceed first to the issues about the agency's
Since we're still on the threshold, could you start with standing? Sorry.
Okay.
You can't get to the merits without standing.
That's okay. With respect to the individual petitioners, the argument is that there's no imminent threat that this court could redress, even assuming that down the road DEA would eventually reschedule, reconsider and reschedule.
No, wait, let me just stop you there, because I actually missed it, and because I think it's the one you have to focus on is Kravitz, which I had not, I had focused on what I think you're about to address, but Kravitz talks about VA medical care, which is now proscribed because the VA is following a U.S. position, and this to me looks like a pretty straightforward Article III standing. I think the others, I know what your argument is, I read it in the brief, and I think that's much more tenuous. Kravitz does looks pretty straightforward. That affidavit does not look infirm to me. Do you disagree? Krauss, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing
yes,
his name.
Krauss.
I want certain treatment. I am a veteran. I go into the VA, and they won't give it to me because of this rule, and I'm required to make different arrangements. I simply had missed that before, but I that wouldn't you agree? That sounds pretty straightforward, right?
Well, it is. It still is not clear how he proposes to obtain medical marijuana. I guess saying that he lives in a state that does not have
he
legal
wants counseling
cannabis
at the VA that he can't get under his medical regime there.
Well, this is what he says. Perhaps if it was in Schedule 2, again, it is not entirely clear that he would even be able to avail himself of such counseling. It would depend, acknowledging that would be a closer case.
You agree that this one makes it a lot harder than the argument you were making about I can't grow my own marijuana?
That would be correct. Again, it is just seems to be somewhat tenuous as to how it's raised as to whether he would be able to get the relief in terms of the counseling, whatever other interaction with the VA. We begin, if it's okay, back to the currently accepted medical use. The DEA could not have been clearer in the 1992 decision when it denied a previous petition to reschedule marijuana as to the information that's necessary to establish currently accepted medical use and treatment in the United States. There was no difference in its analysis of this case with respect to those requirements. More significantly here, though, although the petitioners argue significantly regarding consensus, the underlying fact is that any consensus among scientific experts presuppose that there are adequate scientific studies of efficacy and safety on which to base an opinion as to those issues. Here, HHS concluded appropriately after considering the record that the research on medical use has not yet progressed to a point that would allow such a conclusion. The 1999 Institute of Medicine study with respect to pain, nausea, emesis, wasting syndrome, neurological symptoms, and glaucoma, the five ailments that it specifically addressed, determined that there had not been prior controlled studies. And to the extent that there were, they had not been conclusive. It, in fact, recommended further study with respect to diseases. And as to the other materials cited by the petitioners, there's only a very limited number that involve the actual administration of marijuana to humans, and none on a large scale for evaluating purposes, and all indicated that their results were preliminary and designed to spur controlled clinical trials. With respect to the state laws, the plain language of the CSA does not assign a role to the popular vote in states or state legislative action in determining what is currently accepted medical use. As already discussed, the CSA requires consideration of a variety of scientific information. The Supreme Court's decision in Gonzales v. Oregon did not change this, did not pertain to scheduling, and in fact acknowledged the federal government's primacy in that area. The agency, DEA in this case, applied its the statutory criteria correctly and properly reached the decision that marijuana did not have a currently accepted medical use. If the court has no further questions on that, I will turn to the abuse liability issue. We start with a drug of known psychoactive effect that is used for that effect and the use of which may be accompanied by adverse physical and psychological consequences, both at the time of use and over a period of time. The comparisons that were made were properly made according to the databases used by numerous entities in the United States to track abuse and dependence, which showed that marijuana is the most widely abused illicit drug in the United States during the time of each agency's analysis of the petition and throughout that time, as well as implicated in hundreds of thousands of emergency department visits. The correct pharmacological comparison is to the other tetrahydrocannabinols, which HHS has said are unique substances, and thus that was a proper pharmacological comparison. Grinspoon does not require a pharmacological comparison to substances that are substantially different. As well, the dependence is not a determinative factor, HHS tells us. It has considered a number of factors throughout its involvement in scheduling, and dependence is not a determinative factor with respect to abuse potential. Dependence is a consequence, one of the possible consequences of abuse. It is certainly relevant to some of the other schedules. Is certainly a required finding with respect to some of the other schedules, but it is not so required with respect to Schedule 1. HHS and DEA looked at a variety of factors, and again, based on the extent of abuse, not use, but abuse in the general population of this drug, appropriately concluded that it has a high potential for abuse.
What about these medibles? Are you familiar with these marijuana-infused foods?
Yes.
And is DEA doing anything about regulating them?
They are regulated to the extent that they contain substances that are controlled. They contain THC. They are regulated and they are prosecuted to the extent. They contain some of the substances that may have been recently controlled. They are, and were controlled on an emergency basis for a couple of years now. Yes, those are subject to prosecution as well.
All right.
I appreciated that the argument about the well-controlled studies not being permitted is at best implicit. But what is the government's answer to that argument?
Well, I believe HHS in the opinion. Indicated that it does work with, well, the government's answer is that the studies are not prohibited, first of all. Research is provided for. HHS states that it had its published guidance that it's committed to providing research-grade marijuana for studies that are most likely to yield usable essential data. Now, the fact that there's a requirement that certain protocols be met does not mean that the government is setting an impossible standard. In fact, there have been at least 15 or so in the teens studies that have been approved and for which marijuana has been dispensed by the government to conduct those studies. We're not sure of the results. HHS does not track the results. If they're submitted or published, then we will know that. But aside from that, we don't know. But there is no bar. There are procedures. They're in statutes. They're in regulations. They're publicly available.
The government doesn't know. It dispenses marijuana for a study and doesn't know whether there are any results.
We don't have final results of studies. There are appropriate.
I'm not saying you wouldn't know.
No, there are appropriate controls against diversion made.
Right, but I would. Is it not the case that if you permit a study and dispense marijuana for the study, you expect to hear about the results of the study?
You do expect to hear about the study, but for DEA's purpose, you expect that the marijuana is used for the study and not diverted to some other purpose.
Yes, I understand. But who is it, the FDA then, that would hear about the study? It would certainly be someplace in HHS, right?
Yes, and let me just correct it. What HHS says is that they don't have any information of any NDA quality studies. So that's not to say necessarily that they don't have information about the studies, but they have not received information about studies of a sufficient caliber to allow them to make any findings with respect to whether these studies have demonstrated a currently accepted medical use and treatment. They say the studies are often missing data, not well documented, not well controlled. They don't have the type of study that would allow them or any other expert to reach a conclusion as to the medical utility of marijuana.
Can a patient who goes to a VA hospital in a state that allows medicinal marijuana get it?
I don't know the answer to that, given that it is not a recognized medicine federally, I would presume not, but I don't know the answer to that.
All right. Any questions?
As to whether they could even receive information. Presumably not a recommendation, but I don't know in terms of information about what, you know, studies may have.
You don't know if it's the policy of the VA, if the VA hospital is located in a state that allows it.
They would not allow access. No.
All right. Your time is up.
My time is up. I would rest on our briefs for the remainder and ask the court to uphold the agency's decision, right. Dismiss the petition.
Does Mr. Alford have any time? Why don't you take a couple minutes?
Your Honors, let me try to answer the question that Your Honors posed to me that I did not artfully answer the first time around. Why did we not claim this impossibility to meet this adequate and well-controlled studies criterion in the opening brief? The answer is that it's not clear that that is the standard even being promulgated by the administrative agencies in this case. It was a standard. It's my best guess as to what their standard is, but they don't actually say that you have to have these studies, which is why we phrased our opening brief in terms of, well, we do have adequate and well-controlled studies. In fact, the government, at page 43 of its responsive brief, says, of the materials published after the IOM report, it simply says very few discuss clinical studies involving marijuana.
Well, on that doesn't seem like the right answer, because if I look at JA 239, which is the Federal Register actual discussion by the administrator and not what's said in the briefs, and therefore it is the thing that we have to focus on. It says, drug will be determined currently acceptable medical use for CSA purposes only if all five of the foregoing elements are demonstrated, one of which is adequate and well-controlled studies. And then in the next column, as it goes to reach one, it says, there must be adequate and well-controlled studies proving efficacy, and says DHHS states that no studies have been conducted showing efficacy for any indication in controlled large-scale clinical trials. So they certainly rest on this. I understand your argument that you have those studies, but I don't understand the argument that this didn't put you on notice that you, if you wanted to make some argument about not being able to do that.
Well, they're making a claim that there are no clinical studies. They later make a claim there are very few clinical studies. And, of course, I would submit there are certainly adequate and well-controlled studies, even on their own definition, for THC. They make their argument when they're talking about relative abuse potential that you should compare marijuana to THC, and therefore the studies regarding THC should qualify for marijuana as well, as the IOM implicitly found when it included those studies in the IOM reports. The reason why I say it doesn't really put us on notice is at some points they say there are no clinical studies, then they say to the extent there are clinical studies, they deal with THC, but they don't say that you absolutely have to have these NDA quality studies, or I did not find that in the record. If the court reviews the record and disagrees, the court reviews the record and disagrees. However, the reason why we're not on adequate notice that that is the standard is the announced standard is adequate and well-controlled studies. We presented that to the extent they're claiming NDA quality studies. You have that certainly for THC and with sauce for the goose.
So you're not arguing that they have prohibited you from having adequate and well-controlled studies. You're arguing that they prohibited you from having NDAA.
Exactly, Your Honor. It's our position that we have adequate and well-controlled studies in many of them, and they don't say exactly why they say there aren't any, other than they point to NDA, but they don't say that is absolutely required.
Let me ask you another question about what was raised in the opening brief. So Judge Edwards and I both expressed our somewhat surprise about the Kravitz argument and not remembering it being made. And now looking back, I see why I don't remember it being made, because when you make the argument about standing, you only refer, which is in the blue brief, page 6, you only refer to Kravitz affidavit paragraph 5, which is the one about cultivation.
Yeah.
You don't refer to paragraph 4, which is the one that you discussed with us in your opening. And and as a result, I looked only, I read and marked, I can tell you, the other paragraph, but I didn't see that as being your argument for standing. Your argument for standing seemed to be about cultivation. And you say, also on page 6 and 7, that ASA is standing on behalf of its members because they are deterred from cultivating the medicine they need. And on page 7, you say they would no longer be deterred from cultivating the medicine. But the argument that you opened with, which was the argument about what would happen in the VA hospital, I don't see made in the brief at all.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, we do make the argument that they, as you pointed out, that they feel deterred from being able to obtain the medicine they need, and that's at page 6.
But the reference is to these are all references to paragraphs of affidavits about cultivation as a way of obtaining the medicine.
There's also a general reference on page 6 at the bottom to each of the affidavits, including the Krawitz affidavit. Certainly in our reply brief, we specifically mentioned the Conant versus Walters case and specifically say and I actually cite other cases as well besides the Conant versus Walters case and explain that that people are not able to discuss marijuana with their physicians and that itself is a form of injury. I mean, the problem is there are so many possible bases for standing, and we raised as many of them as we could in the opening brief and then followed up to the extent the government gave responses. And we're somewhat hamstrung here because of the court's decision in the Sierra Club versus EPA case, that you're supposed to give a very concise statement of standing up front in your opening brief in the jurisdictional statement. So it did not seem appropriate to make these full arguments with headings when you're talking about standing.
I think it says concise, does it?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. The exact word is a concise statement that's in under that heading. And so the problem is it becomes very difficult to make every single argument about standing with headings, et cetera, based on what the court has instructed us to do. To the extent that the court wishes it could give a supplemental briefing. I mean, that case as well says for good cause you could actually give either supplemental briefing, but it's certainly in the affidavit, which was submitted right up front, and we did our best to explain all the various theories in a concise fashion.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Okay, you're way over your time. You want to just do a concluding sentence?
I'll do a concluding sentence. Well, I just want to say that a hearing or reopening of the record is required under these circumstances, all this with the substantial evidence test. They get away with some deference under that test when it comes to the merits. However, in terms of a hearing, it switches the other way. They're claiming that there's no substantial evidence to reschedule marijuana. We would submit otherwise. Both parties agree that further study is appropriate. If marijuana is rescheduled, the federal government will loosen its grip on research, as was stated by the court in a slightly different context in the Grinspoon versus DEA case. And we would request that happened so further research could occur to the benefit of medical marijuana patients. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.